The death of a loved one is a traumatic event. The death of a loved one can also be a time of profound spiritual awareness. When James Agee wrote about the death of his father, he recalled one particular incident that filled him with hope. At the graveside service, when his father's casket was being lowered into the grave, a butterfly landed on the lid and just sat there, moving its wings back and forth like butterflies do, gentle as a breath. And that butterfly rode on top of the casket while it was lowered all the way down into the earth. Then, once the casket and the beloved body that it contained had come to rest, the butterfly flew up out of the grave and into the sky. Agee wrote, "There was more of God in that butterfly than in all the words the preacher said." Many of you have similar stories, although you don't necessarily talk about them often. A hummingbird materializes at a window. A rose blooms out of season. A praying mantis comes to rest on your shoulder. Such simple and beautiful elements of the natural world often bring comfort and reassurance at the time of a death. Sometimes peace and hope are mediated through sunlight, as in this person's experience. It was cloudy and overcast on the day of the funeral. Just as we were standing there at the cemetery, the clouds parted, and this light, this beam, came down and lit right on the casket. And I knew then that everything was going to be all right. It's going to be all right. The spirit of the one I love is not completely gone. God is present. Amazing grace is reaching out to me. Life is stronger than death. These are the kinds of affirmations that cannot necessarily be proved or explained with words, but which can come to us very strongly through experiences by which we get a glimpse into eternal realms of the Spirit. A few of Jesus' disciples had such an experience once. It was an experience that they could describe, although not necessarily explain. It was an experience that came back to them and helped them tremendously in the aftermath of Jesus' crucifixion. It was an experience that they kept quiet about for a long time. Maybe they didn't want anybody to laugh at them or question them or shake their faith. But ultimately, they chose to share their experience with the world in the hope that it would bring as much spiritual awareness and reassurance to others as it had to them. This experience is recounted in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 9, verses 28 through 36. I'm going to back up, though, and read about 10 verses leading up to an event that happens on a mountaintop. So I'm going to begin with Luke chapter 9, verse 18. Once when Jesus was praying alone, with only the disciples near him, he asked them, "Who do the crowds say that I am?" They answered, "John the Baptist, but others Elijah, and still others that one of the ancient prophets has arisen." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered, "The Messiah of God." Jesus sternly ordered and commanded them not to tell anyone, saying, "The Son of Man must undergo great suffering and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised." Then he said to them all, "If any want to become my followers, let them deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For those who want to save their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will save it. What does it profit them if they gain the whole world but lose or forfeit themselves? Those who are ashamed of me and of my words, of them the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But truly I tell you, there are some standing here who will not taste death before they see the kingdom of God. Now about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter and John and James and went up on the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly the disciples saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to Jesus. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleepiness, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory and the two men who stood with him. Just as they were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," not knowing what he said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone. And they kept silent, and in those days told no one any of the things that they had seen. There's a lot of meaning in this vision, this experience, that might not be immediately apparent right on the surface of things. For example, if you didn't know that both Moses and Elijah share the unique characteristic of not having died at the end of their time on earth, but rather of having been taken up directly into heaven by God. If you didn't remember that, you might not realize the significance of this conversation about Jesus' departure, his departure rather than his death, that would be accomplished in Jerusalem. If you didn't know the history, you might not see right away that you're being shown a picture of three people who lived on earth at completely different times. But here they are meeting together and talking together at one time in God's eternal presence. Without some understanding of the symbols and the details, you might not grasp right off that you're looking through a window into heaven. A window that has opened up in the here and now to show us the spiritual presence and reality that surrounds us and exists alongside us all the time. Practical experience shows that it's worthwhile to take the time to explore the meaning. A woman named Carol used to get terribly irritated every time her mother came to visit because the mother always insisted on washing all the windows in Carol's house. Carol lives in an old three-story house, and washing all the windows is a huge job, especially because each window is made up of a whole bunch of smaller panes. Carol felt criticized by her mother's action. She wondered why her mother couldn't just rest and relax, enjoy the garden, read a good book. She thought her mother disapproved of her housekeeping. It made her feel tense and resentful. Finally, Carol had the sense to ask her mother, "Why are you doing this?" Mother was glad to explain, "I'm old and tired, and I'm afraid of becoming useless. Washing the windows makes me feel useful. It's a job I can manage. As I wash each small pain, I see I've completed something. It gives me satisfaction." Carol had been missing the point entirely, and getting to the true meaning eliminated her irritation, frustration, and annoyance. And so we take a little time for a brief examination of each of the pains in this window that we call the Transfiguration. When Jesus is infused with light, his appearance is briefly changed, and the disciples get to look for a moment into heavenly realms. If there's a scene anywhere in the whole Bible that could sum up the whole thing, bring together all the parts of the story into one picture, this would probably be the one that comes the closest. The setting is on a mountaintop, a place of refuge and prayer, a place for gaining perspective, a place where God is known to draw near. It was on a mountaintop that Moses received the commandments, which were to be part of the covenant relationship between God and God's people. It was on a mountaintop also that Moses stood and finally looked into the promised land. Elijah communed with God on a mountaintop, hiding in the cleft of a rock to survive first a fierce wind, then an earthquake, then a fire, before finally hearing the voice of God out of a sheer silence. In the Bible, mountaintops are holy places, and Elijah and Moses are supreme examples of people who gave their lives in service to God and to God's people. Moses is the one whose persistence and strong sense of justice became a tool for God in freeing the Hebrew people from their captivity in Egypt. The people had gone to Egypt in the first place to escape a famine in their homeland, but they'd gotten stuck there. They'd become slaves. They were forced to work at the Pharaoh's whim and command. Time after time, Moses came forward to offer evidence of God's power until finally, Pharaoh consented to let them go. Moses then led his people across the water to safety in an event that the Bible calls the Exodus. Moses counseled them, guided them, opened God's provision to them as they journeyed through an empty desert. The word in this conversation between Moses and Elijah and Jesus that our New Revised Standard Version translates as departure, they're talking about his departure, which is about to take place in Jerusalem, could equally well have been translated Exodus. They're speaking about Jesus' Exodus, his liberation, his freeing of God's people, which is about to take place. Elijah was God's prophet generations later in the time of the kings. By this time, the people had settled into the land that God had chosen for them to be their home. And they looked around and they decided that they wanted to be like the other nations. They wanted a king to rule over them, to make decisions for them, to protect them, to ensure their well-being. God tried to warn them, but they wouldn't listen. They insisted they needed a king. And so over time, it turned out that God was right. Sometimes the kings were faithful to God's purposes, and sometimes the kings were not and led the people astray. So the role of a prophet was to call the king to account, to speak for God, even when it seemed like nobody wanted to listen. Elijah was one of those prophets who cared deeply and suffered greatly in his service to God. Like Jesus, who came much later, Elijah had the power to provide food where none seemed to exist, to heal people, even on occasion to raise them from the dead. Elijah insisted that God's people worship God and God alone. So Jesus' companions, his two counselors there on the mountain, were two people who had gone before him and done similar work, linking God and God's will to God's people. According to Luke, this moment of Jesus' transfiguration, this moment when he is seen in all his heavenly glory, comes midway through his time of ministry on earth. He's already been proclaiming in many places to many people that the kingdom of God is at hand. He's healed a whole lot of people of their diseases. He's gathered his group of disciples, fed hungry crowds, calmed a storm, spoken through many stories and through direct teachings about God's way of life, God's purposes, and also he has attracted the attention of hostile critics. When he goes up the mountain to pray, it's 8 days after Peter has identified him as the Messiah, and after Jesus has spoken for the very first time about the suffering and death that he expects to face. But this is a midpoint. Luke goes on to tell a whole bunch more healing and teaching stories after this time on the mountain. According to Luke, the transfiguration happened in the middle of Jesus' ministry, but in many ways it could be, easily be, a picture of Jesus' resurrection or of his ascension into heaven. Luke's resurrection account, which is in Luke chapter 24, specifies two men in dazzling clothes beside the empty tomb. His description of Jesus' departure into heaven, recounted in Acts chapter 1, includes a statement that as Jesus was being lifted up, a cloud took him out of the disciples' sight, and two men in white robes appeared with a question and a promise for the disciples. The event on the mountaintop is both an echo of occurrences in the past as well as a prelude of things to come. It offers reassurance and hope before all those bad things start happening to Jesus. It draws all of salvation history together into one picture, reminding us that God always has been, is today, and always will be acting to save God's people. The disciples are in this transfiguration picture as well. At least three of them are. And they're doing what we followers of Jesus are often found doing, trying to stay awake during the times when it seems like nothing is happening, and then trying to respond appropriately when something startles us into alertness. Peter was so overwhelmed that day, he didn't even know what he was saying. The arrival of the cloud that signified God's very presence, was terrifying to those disciples, and the command to listen stunned them into silence. Certainly the disciples knew that in days of old, God had routinely been present to God's people in the form of a cloud that filled their tent of meeting and accompanied them on their journey through the wilderness. God's glory resided in that cloud. When it was still, the people stayed put. When it lifted up and led them, by day or by night, the people followed. The disciples knew all this, but no one in their own time had ever seen the cloud of presence. When the disciples found themselves surrounded by it, they may have been shocked to realize that God's radiant, mist-enshrouded presence was not just a character in history, but a current and very real force and factor in the world. Jesus on a mountaintop, talking to Moses and Elijah about his departure or his exodus. Three befuddled and amazed disciples looking on. Radiant light, a cloud, and the voice of God in an echo of Jesus' baptism saying, "My son, my chosen, my beloved." If you can recognize all the elements in this picture, then you know quite a bit about the long history of God's interaction, God's relationship with God's people, God's love for God's people. In the Christian church, we revisit this picture window once every year on the last Sunday of Epiphany, which is today, Epiphany being the season in which we celebrate Christ's light that has come into the world for all people. The brilliance of what we see finds an analogy in the experience of a little boy whose family had just moved across the country to a new home in a southwestern state. The geography was different. Everything was different for this child, and so every day seemed to be filled with new discoveries. One evening, while his mom was inside the house unpacking boxes, this three-year-old was out in the yard exploring. Suddenly, he came running into the house. His mother heard his little footsteps, and then she heard him shouting, "Mom, Mom, come quick! The sunset is all over the place!" As when we face an amazing sunset, our words are not entirely adequate to explain what we're looking at. But our hearts can be filled with wonder. The Transfiguration reminds us that every now and then we are given to know that our lives have a deeper meaning. Even though we may be walking through the valley of the shadow of death, even though we face painful or traumatic times, God is with us. We're held in God's hands. And Christ is the one who will lead us home. A disciple of Jesus named Helmut Gollwitzer, who lived and proclaimed his faith during the Nazi era, was detained and thrown into prison by the Gestapo. At that point, of course, Helmut could not choose to climb a mountain to commune with God. He was not allowed to have a Bible in which he could read the stories of how God had saved and guided and directed and comforted God's people in the past. He had to make his own window. And so he found a piece of wire, and he scratched the word Jesus on the wall of his prison cell. And that was enough. Every time I looked at it, he later wrote, every time I looked at it, it said to me that I was not alone. It said to me that God had work for me to do, even here in this place. It said to me that God forgave my weaknesses, that I had a responsibility to my neighbors, that my trust in God was rightly placed, and that things were not as bad as I had feared. Jesus, he's our salvation too. Dear God, as long as life endures, there are so many things in this world that can remind us of your grace and your love. We might be walking on the beach. We might be washing the dishes or reading to a child. We might be digging in the garden. And suddenly and unexpectedly, we're given a glimpse of your truth. We suddenly see for a moment that your love is so much greater than we are and yet is very present to us. We see that you have come in a form we are meant to recognize, a form we are meant to follow, a form of someone who knows us and shares our life with us. You have come in the form of Jesus, the Christ. And we thank you. We thank you for your amazing grace, which reaches out to us, forgives us, guides us, transforms us for good. Your amazing grace, which helps us to become who and what we are born to be. We thank you for showing us enough of your eternal reality that we can pray with eagerness, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We join our voices in the prayer that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.